This is Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at chrisducker.com/Rainmaker.
This is Youpreneur FM, the official podcast of the Youpreneur Mastermind Community. A place where no entrepreneur gets left behind in their pursuit of building a business they can be proud of.
And now,
here's your host, serial entrepreneur and best-selling author, Chris Ducker.
Well, hello and welcome to episode number 126 of Youpreneur FM. I very much appreciate you tuning in, guys. Wow, what an incredible show we have planned for you right now with the one and only Michael Port. The guy's done everything. He's been in Sex and the City. I think that's where it ends. No, he's so much more talented than that. He is an actor, or was an actor. He is an incredible entrepreneur, an amazing public speaker, New York Times bestselling author, of course, of Book Yourself Solid. And now his new book has just hit the stands just a few days ago, Steal the Show. And actually, I enjoyed this conversation so much that I had me and my team put together another one of our exclusive bonus content for our podcast listeners, one of our ebooks there called How to Steal a Show in Business and Life. I know you're going to love it. To grab it for free, you know the deal, head over to chrisducker.com/episode126. That's chrisducker.com/episode126. You can grab it for free right there. And I know you're going to love it. Some really good stuff covered in there. This conversation just blew me away. It honestly, really, truly blew me away. And something else that's been blowing me away over the last week has just been the incredible amount of people showing interest in Youpreneur.com. For those of you who are still getting used to the whole new name, we recently changed, probably around about a month or so ago now, we changed from the new business podcast to Youpreneur FM to coincide with the release and the doors opening of Youpreneur.com, which is my entrepreneurial community where absolutely nobody gets left behind. There's accountability, there's support, there's networking, there's learning, there's exclusive videos and done-for-you training and lots, lots more. If you want to find out a little bit more about that, I've just been humbled with the sheer amount of interest we've had. If you do want to find out a little bit more, you can do. Just head on over to Youpreneur.com. That's youpreneur.com, and I'll see you on the inside. Now, on to my chat with Michael Port. Man, you know what? This is one of the guys that I've been wanting to spend some real quality time with for quite some time, and you'll hear later on in the conversation where I kind of pretty much invite myself onto his yacht mastermind that he holds once a year or so, and he accepted. He said, I'll be the first to be invited next year. So that was good to know. Hey, man, if you don't ask, you don't get, right? Come on. Anybody that knows me knows I'm a big believer of that phrase. But, you know, Michael's just so darn smart. And I let him have the mic on this one. I've got to be honest with you. He gave so many golden nuggets. He dropped so many value bombs on this show on the subject of public speaking and just performing in general, whether it's a sales deal that we're working on, a negotiation, or being on stage in front of hundreds, if not thousands of people. It's a really good conversation, and it's a slightly longer one than we're used to here in our Friday interview format show, but I know you're going to love it. So I'm not going to waffle on anymore. Here's me and Michael chatting up a storm on the subject of how to steal the show. So Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Now, I feel like I should call you Sir Michael Port or something. I mean, if you were a Brit, you would have been knighted by now. Let's not.
Actually, I think if I was a Brit, I'd probably have been kicked out of the country by now.
Hey, you said that, not me. Wow, there's a way to start an interview. Okay, good. Oh, dear. No, I'm genuinely very, very excited to have you on the show. Big fan of the work. Big fan of everything that you do book-wise, everything that you do, you know, speaking-wise. He wrote Public Speaking last year. You rocked it out. Matthew Kimberley, your colleague, my very good fellow Brit of a friend. And just stoked to have you on the show to talk about your new book, Steal the Show.
That's right.
Yes, which just came out literally 72 hours ago. How are you feeling so far?
I'm actually – this is a hologram. This is not me. I'm in 19 right. places right now at the same time.
Yes.
But look, the fact of the matter is, I hate the book launch. I do. I really don't like it. It's exhausting. You know, you're asking for favors left and right.
Yes.
You know, please promote. I don't like it. But look, this is my sixth book, and I know that it's part of the job. And you need to do everything in your power to reach the people you're meant to serve. So I will do anything. I will stay up all night long. I will, you know, I will fly, travel, whatever I have to do, I will go to try to get the book into the hands of the people that I'm meant to serve. Because, look, Steal the Show is not just about public speaking.
No.
Because people in everyday situations need help in all of the everyday performance situations of their life. And especially during the high-stakes situations of your life. So making deals, marketing your products, leading a team, going on a date, these are all types of performances. Now, hopefully they're authentic performances, because the best performers in the world are the most authentic performers in the world. So let's just get that, you know, really clear right off the bat, because sometimes when people think about acting or performing, they think of it as pretending or fake or phony, and nothing could be farther from the truth when it comes to Steal the Show. And stealing the show is not upstaging other people. Stealing the show is the greatest thing you can do for an audience and even for the people you work with, because you're creating something remarkable. You're doing something special. Upstaging people is taking the spotlight away from them intentionally, and that's not what we're talking about here. So
right.
just remember, community, you know, performance, Stealing the Show can be about wowing an audience, but it can also be about connecting with one person intimately, privately, and influencing others so that they think what you think you want them to think, or feel what you want them to think, or do what you want them to do, but in a way that without any manipulation whatsoever.
Right. Okay. So let's sort of start, you know, busting down a few walls here and getting stuck in a little bit with this, because I see, for just based off of that, and you were very kind enough to send me an advanced copy of the book, and it's great, and I've got, you know, well and truly stuck in, but for me, when I was looking through Steal the Show, it kind of feels like it really is a perfect transition from Book Yourself Solid. Like, yeah. you know, it really, truly, it felt like that. Like, I honestly felt like I was just sort of going from one to another. Obviously, Think Big Manifesto, bum, 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 Steal the Show.
Well, the two books that I really were meant to write is Book Yourself Solid and Steal the Show. And I wrote four other, what I think are good books in between, but you know, when you're a creative artist, there are certain things that you're meant to do and others that you really enjoy doing, but ultimately, you know, aren't the things that you're meant to do. And this is the rest of my life. This is the work that I really feel like I was always meant to do, because, you know, I have a master's in acting from NYU, and I had a career as a professional actor. I was on shows like Sex and the City, Third Watch, All My Children, Law and Order. I did different films, The Pelican Brief, Down to Earth, The Believer, and did lots and lots of voiceovers. Voiceovers mm-hmm. was my bread and butter for mm-hmm. companies like AT&T, Pizza Hut, Braun, Coors Beer, Budweiser, MTV. And when I started my own business, I was in large part successful because I could play lots of different roles authentically. And we as human beings play lots of different roles all the time. We might not realize that we're doing it, but we play one role when we're a parent, another role as a child, another role as a friend, another
Absolutely.
Role as an entrepreneur, another role as a boss, another role as a colleague. And we, if we can move seamlessly from one role to another, playing different parts of ourselves, meaning amplifying different parts of our character so that they fit that role very well, then we can seamlessly move from one scenario to another scenario, from one group to another group. And ultimately, we become a lot more popular because people want to be around you. And it's interesting because I'm not talking necessarily about the kind of popularity that, you know, that we see in high school because, you know, the kid with the money gets popular, or the one who's the best looking gets popular, not that kind of thing. But Lee Strasberg, who was one of the great acting teachers, he said that the actor has the ability to consistently create reality and then express that reality. That's what the actor does. The actor creates reality and then expresses that reality. And I used my training as an actor to create a modern methodology for the non-actor to use to steal the show or to shine in all the spotlight moments of their life. And I don't use it as a metaphor. I use it as a model, because if you think about what Lee Strasberg said, this ability to create reality and express that reality, that's what we are doing every single day. We just don't realize that we can do it intentionally the way that an actor does create their own character. So my question often is to people, how do you want to be known? And do you let the past determine the future? Is your future predicated on your past? And I don't think it is. And what kind of reality do you want to create for yourself going forward? And so Book Yourself Solid was, you know, the business side of that.
Right, right. Very
and
much
Steal
so.
The Show, Steal the Show is the personal side of that. It's the branding side of that. It's the performance side of that. I mean, there, it's broken up into three parts. The first part is the performer's mindset. It's the way you see the world, because the performer can see himself or herself playing lots of different roles comfortably, being comfortable with the discomfort that comes along with new experiences. And then the second part is the performer's principles, the principles that a performer adheres to so that they can be very, very compelling performers. And then part three is really a masterclass in public speaking specifically, because this is an area that I have spent the last 12 years. And when I combine my experience as a platform speaker, you know, at the highest levels with my training as an actor, I've been able to really pinpoint this very, very specific methodology for using acting as a public speaker, even if you're not an actor. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've done by combining those two things over the years.
Okay. I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, I kind of draw upon everything I know about you, and I do think public speaking. To me, that's who you are. You're an amazing keynote speaker. I've seen your videos. I've yet to see you live, but I've seen enough footage of you to know that you're a bloody good keynote speaker. You know, the term I use a lot is, you know your job. You know, when you get interviewed by Andrew Warner at Mixergy, you are drained at the end of that interview because he knows his job. He's the best interviewer on the planet when it comes to podcasts, as far as I'm concerned. You, when I watch you on stage, you're an amazing, amazing public speaker. And actually, a little tidbit of information for you guys tuning in, Matthew Kimberly, who's been on the show recently, is you know, very close to Michael in the Book Yourself Solid kind of job and well, not job, but business and realm and all the rest of it. And when Matthew spoke, and I'd seen clips of Matthew on stage, obviously, but when Matthew spoke at Tropical Think Tank, within 5 minutes, less than that, 3 minutes of him being on stage, he blew the entire conference apart. And it was quite obvious where he's got all his tips and tactics from. But no, I mean, but you know, I blow a little bit of smoke up his ass. But I mean, ultimately, that's how I see you.
I was just doing a Periscope the other day, and yep. someone said, "Oh, hey, did you train Matthew Kimberly? Because he was the best speaker I saw at your event in the Tropical Think Tank."
Right.
I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm talking to I know Chris. I'm talking to Chris really soon." So he was really well received. And yeah, he's, of course, we've been working together for a long time. He's my partner in the Book Yourself Solid side of the business. And he runs the Book Yourself Solid School of Coach Training. And so he's quite remarkable. And he's a performer himself, but he's an entertaining performer. And I think that sometimes when people see folks who would be what you'd consider natural performers, mm-hmm. real entertainer types, have the gift of the gab, funny, think on their feet really quickly, they often discount their own ability to perform because they say, well, I'm not an entertainer, so I can't be a performer.
Right.
But I don't think you need to be an entertainer to be a performer, because in performance, people think is about self-expression. I think it's more about self-understanding.
Hmm.
I think you appear fully self-expressed when you have a really clear, true sense of who you are. And I think that's important, because sometimes what we are trying to show people or trying to tell people about ourselves is different than the way we actually think about ourselves.
Indeed. No, I would agree.
But the fact of the matter is, everything we say and everything we do tells the world something about us. And so if we really understand who we are and we're comfortable being that person, we really understand ourselves, and then we are very attractive because we're fully self-expressed. So chapter one is about finding your voice.
So how do we do that? Let's say we figured out what we want to be known for. We figured out what our brand is going to be, and now we want to start performing, whether it be on stage or for our YouTube channel. Maybe it's Periscope. Maybe it's a podcast, possibly, right? I mean, this is all performing. How do we find our voice?
Well, let's start by examining our prejudices about performing and scrape away our false persona. Because finding our voice is less about going in search of it and more about stripping away the layers of false persona that we've wrapped ourselves in, which we think are armor, but in fact, they are parchment-like armor that as soon as somebody criticizes you, they start to poke holes in it, and it starts to hurt. Another chapter in part one is about silencing the critics, crushing your fears and silencing the critics. And I think it's very hard to silence the critics if you don't strip away your false persona and examine your prejudices about performance, about yourself, about other people. Because when others criticize you, it only hurts when you have the same voices of judgment in your head about yourself. So there are two types of voices of judgment. There's the internal critics and the external critics. Mm-hmm. And the internal critics are the repeating loop of negativity that you hear about yourself that maybe came from one of your parents or both of your parents or your teachers or, you know, kids in school. Right. You know, a lot of this comes from, you know, our childhood, but
I can't do it. I'm not good enough. People are going to laugh at me. Right.
And here's the thing. This is called the performer's paradox. Okay. The performer's paradox is as follows. Number one, you have this is what I call the performer's paradox, at least. You have this really clear intention to go out in the world and do big things. You know, you want to make something happen. You want to ship something. You want to, create a personal brand identity and build a tribe around that. And that's something exciting to you. But you have this other intention not to screw up. You have this other intention to make sure that you don't do anything that people would criticize, where people would laugh at you, anything that would be uncomfortable. And those two intentions, they cancel each other out. And then you spin your wheels for a long time and don't achieve the things that you want, but you're pretty safe. Nobody really laughs at you too much because you're not out in the world. You know, you're not putting yourself out there taking risks.
Right.
And here's what happens is that the more that you want to perform, often the harder your subconscious fights to keep you playing small because it's trying to protect itself.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that we can do is to stop apologizing for our voice. I was working with somebody who was doing a broadcast TV event, and it was an all-day event. And after the first segment, she sent me a text and she said, "How's I'm doing?" And I said, I don't talk in terms of good or bad. I just don't think that when we're talking about creative work, that's helpful.
Right.
We focus on what's working and what we can improve in terms of our objective. And that's actually the first chapter of part two is what objective are you trying to achieve when you're performing or public speaking? Because that's the absolute most critical place that we start. And then we can really amp up our motivation to achieve that. And it helps create a clearer intention. But she said, how am I doing? And I said, these are the things that are working really, really well. And here's what I think you can improve. I said, stop apologizing for yourself. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, you've told a number of stories that are very, very important stories that you need to share in order to demonstrate to the audience that you understand the way they see the world. That's a critical component in the introduction of any idea to an audience. They need to know that you know how their world looks. And these stories are demonstrating that you've experienced what they've experienced.
Right.
But you've told two stories where when you began the story, you said, I'm going to share something about myself. I apologize for sharing something about myself. And right. then the second time you said, okay, here I go again. I'm going to share something. But you're on that stage to share. That is why you are there.
Right. That's why people are watching you, because they want you to right. share. Right.
So there was another time where I was doing a masterclass and a woman started off her speech and she tried some self-deprecating humor at the beginning, which is often effective when you're speaking. But instead of self-deprecating humor, she cut her legs out from under her. She said, I'm really sorry that you have to listen to me.
Wow.
And I nearly fell off my chair.
Oh, my God. I literally just picked myself off my –
yeah. wow. And so she – you know, these are apologies for the voice. But right. if you – but people want to know that your voice is strong. It doesn't mean you're a know-it-all. You know, I don't believe there's any one way to do anything. I think that especially when it comes to creative art, you know, what I do is I offer my methodology, my worldview, and it really connects with some people. And with other people, somebody else's methodology or somebody else's worldview will really connect with them. And that's a beautiful thing. And if you truly, truly care about serving people in your area of expertise, then you're cool with them learning from other people because you want them to succeed whether they work with you or not. So, and often when I'll start a speech, I'll talk about this idea that I'm going to introduce my perspective. It doesn't mean it's the right one. It's not the only one. There's lots of different room. And what it does is it gives people the opportunity to have different opinions and still appreciate yours without creating a conflict between yours and theirs.
Right.
Interestingly enough, there was a study done in 2010 by the Journal of Psychological Science, and they found that women tend to apologize more than men.
Hmm.
Now they found that men were just as willing to apologize, but they had a higher threshold for what they thought they needed to apologize for.
Right. Right.
And I apologize if that was an inappropriate thing to share, but
no need to apologize.
See what I just did?
Yeah, I gotcha.
So that's my point, is that we'll often say something and then apologize for it right afterwards. And, you know, and so it's easy to question ourselves. You know, what can I say that hasn't been said before? What can I do that hasn't been done before? And this is a real big issue in our industry because, you know, a lot of us do similar things, and that's great. And people come into the industry and go, well, you know, Chris is already doing this thing. I can't do something like that. Chris right. is already doing
it. I hate yeah. it when people say that. There's absolutely yeah. no – and that's what the business of you, youpreneur, the whole thing, that's exactly what that is all about to me. It's like it doesn't matter what industry you're in, what market you're in, what audience you're speaking to, how much – quote unquote competition there is surrounding you. The fact of the matter is when you build the business around you, there is no competition. Be yourself. You're the original.
Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes we have this fear of being found out. And that right. gives us another reason not to pursue a goal because, well, they say, well, I don't know. I mean, you know, anybody could take me seriously doing this? Or, I mean, this is something that people on all levels have. One of my closest friends is a very highly regarded doctor, you know, researcher, one of the top in his field. And he does a lot of TV interviews because of the work that he does.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me a couple months ago, he was asking for some tips because he was starting to get a little bit nervous on camera. And so we were talking about it. And he said, you know, I feel like a fraud sometimes when I give speeches or when I'm answering questions on the camera, because I feel like the people who I'm speaking to, these other doctors and researchers, they're smarter than I am.
Mm.
And, you know, and sometimes I feel like a fraud. And I feel like, oh my God, he's at the absolute top of his field in one of the most intellectual professions there is. And he feels like a fraud. So it's very normal to feel like that. But if you don't worry about being found out, then you're comfortable with yourself. Again, this is self-understanding. Then you're comfortable with yourself and you find your voice that way. So if we're hiding something big about ourselves, we will often play it small. We'll fade into the background because the bigger you get, the more likely it is somebody's going to find out that thing you're hiding.
Mm.
So stop hiding and you'll get bigger and more visible a lot more quickly.
Okay, so let's say, and this is all great. I love this stuff. So I could talk about this all night. I hope you guys tuning in are buckled in here. okay, so let's say we stop hiding. Let's say we want to get out. Let's say we want to start our own performances. What can we do prep-wise? Because I know for me, before I get on stage for the first time with a new keynote, I am prepping and practicing. And even if I do the same keynote over and over and over again, like a lot of keynote speakers do to different types of audiences, I don't care if I've practiced that thing 50 times. Before I get on stage, even if I've delivered it live 50 times, I'm still going to run through it a couple of times that morning before I'm on stage in front of 1,000 people.
Chris, you're about one in a million.
Oh, God, really?
Okay. You're about one in a million. And I work with a lot of the A-lister speakers.
That's sad to hear that, because I think it's important.
Many of them don't do this. Mm. And it's interesting. I work with, obviously, lots of different people at different levels. And just recently, we did a three-day masterclass with A-listers, people, you know, all in the $20,000-plus range for their speeches. And then right after that, we had 3 days of people who were coming into the business and wanting to make something of themselves as speakers. And interestingly enough, because they were so close together, it was so easy to evaluate one group against the other.
Must have been good.
It was really neat. So the group that was already working professionally, they had a bit more skill because they'd been doing it for a long time. But interestingly enough, they didn't have that much more natural talent than the group that was coming in who hadn't yet done it.
Right.
The biggest difference was their swagger.
Right.
They felt that they should be on the stage.
Right.
Whether or not they were doing a good job was only half the part of it for them.
Yeah, but they just felt. I was going to say, isn't that half of it, though? I mean, maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's a lot more than half of it. Like, just to have that confidence inside of you, to know what your voice is, and that people must hear this voice. They must get this performance right now, today. I mean, isn't that half of what makes people a good speaker?
I think it is. It's the talent part of it is only a small piece. And so let's turn swagger into something that we feel we're more comfortable with. Because if I translate that, I can also see it as service. I can also see it as they really want to help people.
Right.
And they are willing to put themselves up in front of those people and face potential criticism to be in service of that audience and in service of their own destiny, they want to do with their lives. So both of those intentions for them are very, very strong. So they don't suffer the consequences of the performer's paradox. So that's first. Now, to your point about rehearsing, this is very, very important. There is in Steal the Show, I outline a 7-step rehearsal process, because most people, when they rehearse, they just run through it a few times in their mind in their hotel room the morning before they give the speech. That's not rehearsal. Or what they do is they put their slides together first and then try to organize their speech around their slides, and then they use their slides as cue cards.
Yes.
Slides, I think, visuals, anything that you are adding to a speech, which I like to think of as a performance, because then you think of it more about showing than telling, and you think about it more theatrically. Mm-hmm. Anything that you're adding in visually, you do after you've written the speech, after you've created
Agreed.
The content.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because you want to be able to deliver this without any supporting material whatsoever. And if you need your slides to know where you are, then I don't think you're rehearsed enough yet. That's one of the metrics. People say, well, how do I know if I'm well rehearsed? If you need anything to remember where you are in the speech, you still need more rehearsal. Now, that's not the case for, say, a toast at a wedding. You can have your notes. That's different. But if you want to go on the stage and speak in front of 1,000 people, that's an entirely different story. Mm. So I think that's a good litmus test to use. When you are starting a speech, when you're starting to create, before we get to rehearsal, I want you to think about these things when you're starting to create a speech. Number one, what's the big idea that supports it? Okay, what's the big idea? Because the big idea is the through line that drives your entire message. And number two, what's the promise? That big idea delivers on some kind of promise. So if I give a Book Yourself Solid keynote, it's obviously the promise is you're going to get booked solid if you adhere to this particular methodology. Okay. And the big idea behind it is that marketing doesn't actually get you any clients. It's what you do once somebody becomes aware of you that books you the business. Okay. Now you might say, well, Michael, that's not like an earth-shattering idea. That's not going to, you know, we're not going to create world peace because of that idea. Of course not. But that's not what the speech is about.
Right.
Right. The speech is about booking business. So let's get, you know, really sort of practical, straightforward idea, and let's deliver a promise based on that idea. So that's first and second. Then third, you need to be able to demonstrate to the people in the room what the consequences of not adhering to that big idea or not adopting that big idea and going after the promise that's in your speech. Because often when you're asking people to change something, you're asking them to confront something about themselves. If you're asking somebody to change a long-held belief or to change the way they've been doing something for the last 10 years.
Even if they've been successful with it, right? This is what I see. Like, I don't need a change. I'm already successful. But if you make the change, maybe you'll be more successful.
Exactly. So you may right now have a $1 million business, but actually it's a failed $10 million business.
Right, exactly. Right, right.
That's what I always say about my business. I think I have a failed $50 million business.
Right.
Yeah. So
you should probably start following some of your own advice.
Right? Exactly.
Because I feel like, I don't know about you guys tuning in, and why don't you tweet at Michael Port, at Chris Ducker, tweet us and let us know whether you think this call thus far, 30 minutes in, is worth, I don't know, what, 25 grand in consulting fees? Because I think it is already.
I
just
want to
say that.
I'm going to say 50 million in consulting. Okay.
Okay.
25. Fine. So,
I got a copy of the book as well. Remember, that makes up for the difference.
That's right. That's exactly right. So you've got the big idea. You've got the promise. You are clear on what the consequences look like because they need to feel that in order to start to recognize, well, maybe I'll pay attention. And then number four, the rewards. What are the rewards that you will experience if you adopt this idea and you go after this promise and achieve it? Because that's ultimately what people are going after. But sometimes we forget the consequences. And if we can demonstrate the consequences, then we're demonstrating what the world looks like to them. They go, you know what? This person knows our world.
Hmm.
And that initial approach is very, very helpful. It gets you very clear. The big idea, the promise, the consequences, the rewards. Then you can start to use some of the different frameworks that I've put in Steal the Show to organize all of your information. Because the better organized your information, the more consumable it is. So the more consumable it is, the more people will adopt it. The more they will adopt it, the more successful they'll have. The more success they'll have, the more success you'll have.
Right.
And often the big difference between the novice and the expert is the expert's information is better organized.
Right.
So there are a number of frameworks, which we can go through if you'd like. I also want to go through the 7-step process for rehearsing. But there are a number of
we should go through
frameworks.
Everything. Let's go
through
everything.
Let's do it. Let's hit the frameworks first, then we'll go into rehearsal. So there are frameworks. The first framework, most straightforward framework. Let's use books as examples because most people have read the books I can use as examples, but they haven't seen the same speeches.
Okay.
So more people have read Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People than seen almost any speech except maybe Martin Luther King's speech.
Right.
So that is a numerical framework. It's very straightforward. There are 7 keys. Now, Stephen has passed, but when that information is being shared, he can go in order from 1 to 7 or he can go from 7 to 1. It doesn't really matter what order they're in. He could teach just 1 key or he could teach 3 keys or he could teach all 7 keys. So there's a lot of flexibility in that kind of format. And it's very easy for the audience to consume, for the user, the reader, the audience to consume.
Okay.
Very, very popular in self and business help. And my problem when I started writing, and I've had to work to overcome this year after year, is I want what I do to be different and really clever. And when you focus on being different and really clever, sometimes you miss the point. And the point is the audience wants this information simply. Not simplistically,
mm-hmm.
but simply so that they can consume it. And this is what I work for in my books. And Book Yourself Solid is a great example of that because people often say, you know, Michael, I've heard a lot of the things in Book Yourself Solid, but I've never seen it organized that way. It was so much easier for me to go about doing all those things because there was a methodology.
Right.
And I did the same thing with Steal the Show. It's very well organized. That's always my goal. And I think one of the reasons I can do that is because I'm dyslexic. Because in order for me to make sense of the information, I have to organize it in a very consumable manner. And then as a result, it helps other people do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one framework you can use. The second framework is the chronological framework. this, then this, then this, then this. It's a step-by-step process. It's your pregnancy week by week by Glade Curtis. You don't really want to read about, you know, week 30 before you're, when you're still in week 7. You get, just stay where you are, or else you get really freaked out. At least I did at the time I had my, you know, son. So, so you go chronologically. Book Yourself Solid works that way. It's chronological. You do this, then this, then this, then this. In Steal the Show, I've organized it in a way that it is chronological. However, I also organize it in such a way that it's modular. So there are two frameworks there, modular and chronological, because I have these big chunks, these big ideas that need to be broken up. And one is the mindset, two are the principles, and three are the specific techniques, a masterclass in public speaking. And then inside of those, they're organized in a way that is chronological. I want you to think about this first, and this first, then this first. However, part two is organized in a numerical framework. So you can actually mix and match these frameworks in the different speeches and books that you're creating. It's so nice to have something to enter into, some sort of framework. So you have numerical, chronological, modular. You also have compare and contrast, which is a very, very interesting framework that Jim Collins used on his book, Good to Great, which I'm sure you've read, one of the most popular business books in the world.
Absolutely.
He compared great companies and he compared good companies. And he said, well, here's what's similar, here's what's different. Now, why don't you go do what's different? And you too could have a great company. And it's so easy to see the picture. It's just like I was doing some work with my investments on Vanguard the other night, and I was comparing two different funds. And I was able to look at all the particulars for each one and what's different in each fund. And then I can, I can determine why there's a difference, or I could read an article or a book by somebody who's an expert, who has a very clear picture of why it's different. And then I get it. So the compare and contrast is very helpful. Then there's also problem solution, another excellent framework. Here's a problem. Here's a solution. Here's a problem. Here's a solution. A colleague of mine that I used to work closely with many, many years ago, wrote a book many, many years ago called Why Parents Love Too Much. And it was all about the helicopter parents. And he said, look, here are the problems that occur when you're a helicopter type parent. And there are 10 of them. I don't know how many he has.
I think I've heard about this somewhere. I'm not quite sure where, but okay, keep going. Yeah, I've heard of that. I've definitely heard of this.
Here's a solution for each one, right? The 10, you know, problems that all new bloggers face, right? And then boom, 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 you have a solution for each one. So for articles, you can use these frameworks, for books, for speeches, et cetera. And these frameworks help you in. So numerical, chronological, modular, compare and contrast, and problem solution. There are five, and you can integrate them as need be in the work you're doing, and your information will be a lot easier to consume.
Hmm.
How do you like them apples?
I love those kind of apples. They're the best kind of apples. I mean, for me personally, and I think, you know, framework, process, flowchart, checklist, whatever you want to call it, there's something that people just connect themselves to when, you know, like you said, when there's something there that's kind of almost proven and tested, like just do, it's like, you know, order one from column A and one from column B and then pick up your Chinese at the window. You know what I mean? It's just, it's simple that you follow it and it'll work out and you'll get your chow mein, you know?
For me, what I like, for me, what I like about this is that it's a way in. Because again, there isn't one way to do it. And you might actually break the rules and make something better. But what the frameworks do and what the systems do, the processes, is it allows you in. And once you know the way the world works, then you can start to create your own world. But you need to know the way the world works first. And that's really important. So let's talk about rehearsal process.
Let's do that.
All right. So 7 steps. Number one, I'm going to read them all. And then I'm going to go through and I'm going to detail all of them, okay?
Love it.
So number one is table reads. So that's table reads, reading at the table. Number two, content mapping, mapping your content. Number three, blocking, like little blocks. Number four, improvisation and rewriting. So number four, improvisation and rewriting. Number five, invited rehearsal. Number six, open rehearsal. And number seven, dress tech rehearsal. Okay. So let's go through these. And again, remember how I said that acting is not a metaphor for stealing the show, but a model for Stealing the Show. And Steal the Show is a book for non-actors about how they can shine during all the high-stakes situations of their life. And we want to rehearse for the high-stakes situations. We want to rehearse for a job interview. We want to rehearse for a networking meeting with a high-status client. We want to rehearse for all of these situations that we care about, where there's a particular outcome that we want to create.
Right.
Now, even though we're well rehearsed, we are still in the moment and we don't get so married to what we've rehearsed that we can't adapt and improvise.
Love
now,
it.
This is
okay.
Critical.
Yes.
Critical. Because if you are so, and this is the thing, people will say, well, I don't want to be too rehearsed because, well, then I won't seem natural. No, the better you rehearsed you are, the more you can throw away what you've rehearsed so you can be in the moment. So what you've rehearsed comes back to you so organically that it seems like it's the first time it's ever happened.
Hmm.
It's just like going to watch a Broadway play. Some of the performers in the play you're watching have been doing it for a year. 8 shows a week for a year.
Oh, yeah.
And yet it seems like it's all happening in the moment and it's tugging at your heartstrings and it's just so beautiful. It's so dramatic and so passionate. They've got to make it real and new every single night. And the reason they can do that is because they're not thinking about what line is coming next. They can respond to what's happening in the moment from the other performers. Because they're so well prepared, it seems so naturalistic and authentic.
Mm.
And that's what we're going for with rehearsal. So I want to make sure nobody writes off rehearsal because they say, well, no, I tried to rehearse once. I tried to remember exactly what I was going to do and I felt stiff. I was better if I just winged it. And the reason is because they didn't give enough rehearsal. They just gave lip service to the rehearsal, just a little bit of rehearsal. So they were sort of prepared. And what it did is it made them feel stiffer because they were trying to remember what they had rehearsed. And so they felt better if they just completely made it up on the spot.
Hmm. Do you think, let me interject here real quick. Do you think there's ever a time, and you know, maybe, I mean, for me, I can't see it. I mean, I've been in sales since I was 17 years old. I can tell you right now that I've gone into big meetings where I've rehearsed and practiced certain sales strokes and rebuttals to objections I know are going to come my way. I've practiced those babies over and over and over again when I've gone into deals of, you know, anything from $10,000 upwards to multi-million dollar deals. And being rehearsed and prepared has always helped me. Now, those haven't always gone my way, but at least I had in my mind, I had like a real fighting chance of winning that negotiation or coming out on top with that meeting.
Yeah.
But my question to you, and I'm curious, is there ever a time, do you think, when rehearsing is a bad thing?
I haven't seen any time when rehearsing is a bad thing.
Okay.
Getting too married to our plan can be problematic.
Right. Okay. Yes.
So that's the issue. I don't think rehearsal is a problem in any scenario, but I just think getting too married to it can be a problem.
Yeah, where you can't deviate away from sort of just following one path, right?
Yeah, that's the distinction.
Yeah.
So for example, when I originally pitched this book to the various publishers, I was in with the crew, a whole big group from St. Martin's Press. And I had obviously worked on the proposal. I'd worked on the way I was going to present it. I decided how I wanted to be perceived. And, you know, so I created a character around that for those particular meetings mm-hmm. based on who I really am. Because, you know, you go in and sometimes you feel like the best side of yourself didn't come out. And you might not have thought about how to bring out the best side of yourself before you went in there. And that's, again, character development and making sure that character can come through even when you're really nervous. And people often ask me, Michael, what's the best way to overcome stage fright? Because I'm really nervous before I speak. And the answer is not always satisfying because the answer is be better prepared. If you know what you're doing, if you have technique and you're well rehearsed, because in order to be well rehearsed, you usually need technique. And that's why part 3 is all about the technique. If you're well rehearsed, if you have technique, you're less nervous because you're prepared. Generally, if we know what we're doing, we're not that nervous about it. I'm not nervous to be on a podcast with you because I've done hundreds and hundreds of podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I've experienced. But the first time I was ever on a podcast, I was nervous about it. I didn't want to make any mistakes. I didn't want the technology to screw up, etc. Well, now I know how it all works. I've got it all set up. I'm well rehearsed, I'm prepared, and I have the skill to do it. So it's not nerve-wracking anymore. So that's not the answer everybody wants. You know, often people want the answer, which is like, okay, just do 3 deep breaths and then think of the audience in their underwear.
Or naked or whatever, right?
Which is the weirdest, worst advice I've ever. I mean, I don't understand that. Where did that even come from?
Do you know where that originated from?
I have no idea. It's the only advice that's worse is rehearsing in front of a mirror. That's the only advice that's worse.
Right.
Because if you're rehearsing in front of a mirror, the person you're responding to is you making the expressions that you're making, saying the things you're saying. It makes no sense.
Right, which you see every day of your life anyway, right? Yeah.
And you just make yourself uncomfortable. I don't like looking at myself. I'm like, oh, that's a weird face. Oh, right. Your ears are like lopsided. What's wrong with, you know? That just doesn't work, you know? It just doesn't work. So
let me ask you this real quick. Do you ever, with the amount of prep work that you still do now yourself, do you ever get nervous before you hit the stage?
Yeah, absolutely, because I care. Right. That's different than stage fright.
Yes.
Yeah, like, you know, I'm care. I want to make sure, you know, I've got – it's a high energy situation. There's a lot of anticipation. So I like that feeling of nerves, because if I don't have a little bit of feeling of nerves, then I don't – I think maybe I don't care that much. Mm. Do you know?
Oh, yeah.
The difference is, like, I'm excited to get on and do this with you, and I want to do a great job. But I'm not anxious. Those two things are different. Anxiety and a little bit of nerves are very, very different. Anxiety is often excitement without a plan or skill. Mm. That's how I think about it. But if you have a plan and skill, you can still be a little bit nervous, but you won't be anxious. And anxiety is what kills.
Right.
So back to the St. Martin's Press. I went in there with my plan, and then I realized the publisher of the division was a really open-minded guy, and he said he did some acting classes in college 30 years ago. I said, all right, can I get you up on your feet? I'm going to play a game with you. And he's like, and he said, okay, I'll do that. That sounds cool. So I had him and then a few other people in the room up on their feet doing some improv games to demonstrate some of the principles in the book. And it killed. It was absolutely outstanding. It was one of the best meetings. I ended up going with a different publisher, but you know, they wanted the book. They were really excited about it. And I had to completely improv in the moment because I saw the opportunity. But then I needed to get them back down afterwards and get back to the quote-unquote script that I had worked on to make sure, you know, I'm able to get in the points that, you know, that they need to hear in order to buy the book. Mm. So that's where you deviate from plan, you go right back to it. Or, for example, a few months ago, I did a speech for an organization, and there were about 800 people there, and they were supposed to start at 10 o'clock. They were supposed to start at 9:45. I was supposed to go on at 10 to 11. Well, they didn't start till 10. I went on at 10:20 because they had 20 minutes of opening remarks. So I cut my speech down to 40 minutes from 60. I've got to improv in that moment. I've got to know how I'm going to take all of the things I want to do and still deliver my promise, but what I need to cut, you know, and make sure I can get it into the exact right amount of time, right, and still kill it. That's where the better prepared you are, the easier it is to do that. It's not, you're not married to it.
And absolutely,
this 7-step process for rehearsal is what allows you to do that. So you do your initial creative process, and you don't have to write out scripts word for word and then memorize them, although you can. Some people like that and are quite skilled at that. You can also, of course, create your outline with your key points and your stories, et cetera. And we should talk about stories if we have time, because stories, you know, almost every article I've ever seen about public speaking starts with tell a story. But I think they leave out a word, and the word they leave out is good.
Yes, right.
Tell good stories. And right. And if you open a speech with a story that's not great, it's going to be more problematic than if you open a speech with no story at all. So we create this outline with our key points based on the structure that we developed, or we create a scripted speech based on the frameworks that, you know, that we just walked through. And then we sit down at the table with that. And we do what's called a table read, and we read it numerous times out loud, essential, because the written word and the spoken word sound very different.
Mm-hmm.
And we can start to hear what works and what needs improvement. We can start to hear where the holes are, because we start to say, when I actually verbalize that, that argument doesn't hold water. I'm missing something. Okay. Well, then you can go back to your script and you start doing some edits. Then you get back to the table and you read it out loud. You don't do it up on your feet. You don't try to perform it. You're just reading it to make sense of it, but you're reading it out loud. Very few people do this. It's the first thing that all actors do when they are going to do a movie, play, TV show, etc. There's always the table read. The second step is content mapping. Now, this is a little bit more technical. There's a video that people can watch on content mapping at steeltheshow.com. That's steeltheshow.com. And I walk through in that video how to content map a speech. And in Steal the Show, in fact, there are illustrations of some of my speeches content mapped. And what you're doing with content mapping is you're finding your operative words, your beats, which are often where your pauses are and transitions are from one idea to another. And this way, you're able to make crystal clear sense of everything that you're saying. The operative words are the most important words. They're the words that must be hit for an audience to understand what you're talking about. And let me give you a little bit of an example. Let me take something from the book. Let me take something from the book. Okay. Here's one bullet point. Okay. The bullet point is ask them to note when they see an issue. Okay. Now, you could say see is an operative word or maybe issue. So let's try it. You say, well, is see more important or is issue more important? Ask them to note when they see an issue. Ask them to note when they see an issue. Oh, which would you think would be more operative?
I would say the first.
Ask them to note when they see an issue. Ask them to note when they see an issue.
The first. I'm going to stick with the first. Prove me wrong, though, if you feel like you want to. Go on.
Yeah, so content mapping is our choices that you're making. There isn't always a right or wrong. In that case, you could go either one and the audience would get it.
Right.
I might go issue, but that just would be my preference. It's not a right or wrong in that case. However, here would be wrong, okay? This is how you do it. If I chose the wrong operative word, let's say I chose to as the operative word. Ask them to note when they see an issue.
Right.
It just be that doesn't, right? Ask them to note when they see an issue.
Mm.
Ask them to note when they see an issue. You know, these different operative, if you're choosing the wrong operative word, it puts a whole new meaning on the particular sentence. So you can look at your content and start to map it out. And people say, yeah, but shouldn't I just be able to figure that out naturally? You would think, but when you start to watch people speaking, so many of their points are lost because they're not emphasizing the right words.
Right.
They're missing the key parts of their stories or their key parts of their content because they're missing the operative words. Mm. Then there are the transitions, the beats. And what I did right there is a beat.
It's a pause.
It's a pause. And the pause also demonstrates that it's time for a transition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm going to just open up a page here, just a random page, and I'll find a place for a transition. Okay. So let's say I'm reading this paragraph and the end of it says, the DA justifies his advocacy with statements such as, well, we can't take off with a half-baked idea. The truth is, just as there are no fully baked cakes that don't pass through a half-baked stage, the same applies to ideas. Now, the deeper truth is that your colleagues, you see, there's a transition.
Sure, yeah.
And when you find those transitions in your material, then you can start to move into blocking. Now, blocking is when you get up on your feet and you actually start to decide where you're going to be throughout the entire presentation. And this is another one that very few people do. Most people wander.
Right.
Now, I'm sure you've seen this pacing back and forth, wandering around the stage.
It's absolutely brutal when you see a speaker doing that.
It's brutal. Why? Because they've never rehearsed
on
their feet. So they haven't done any blocking. And blocking is where you're going to go at any point. And the beats, the transitions, are often what enable you to move. They allow you to move. They inspire you to move. Now, we don't just move for movement's sake. And there's no, you know, there's an organization that says you should just always walk in a W on stage. It's a strange thing. But it doesn't make any sense. Every movement for all speeches is different. And the more contrast you have in a presentation, the more exciting it is. So there's emotional contrast, there's delivery contrast, and there's content contrast. So delivery contrast means sometimes you move into the audience. Sometimes you sit down on the edge of the stage. Sometimes you cross stage right. Sometimes you run across the stage to stage left. Sometimes you cross up stage. Sometimes you stand on a chair. Sometimes you lie down. All these different devices that you have where your body can be used as a tool for telling a story, telling the whole story, for getting connected to them. That's what your blocking is. And this is, I mean, when we worked with this A-lister group recently, this was the area that none of them had ever done this. And most of them kind of wandered around. And they'd figured out ways to make it so that it wasn't terrible. Mm. But when they started knowing this, I don't move ever in this particular story until I hit this transition. And then bang, I make a cross to the other side and transition into this other idea. It created so much more dynamic depth and excitement and connection with the audience that they were hooked for life. So number one is table reads. Number two is content mapping. Number three is blocking. Number four is improvisation and rewriting. The some of the best work is done on your feet when you're rehearsing. Because the more that you tell a story, the more that you realize what needs work. It's not just at the computer. That's not where your recreation does. And, you know, writing is rewriting, but in performance, writing is often done on your feet because you experience it in a different way. Then you say, and then you record it, get it down, then go back and put it back into your script so you don't forget what you did that was different. Number five is invited rehearsal. This is where you invite just a few people in to give you some feedback, and you tell them what kind of feedback you're looking for on which parts of your presentation. So you don't have to do the whole presentation. There might be certain parts that you're working on that you want some feedback on.
Yep.
And you don't ask them to tell you if it was good or not. You ask them to look for specific things like, was my big idea really clear? Or what is my big idea? What's the promise that I'm offering? What are the consequences? What are the rewards? All of the different key elements that need to be in place. Once you do that, once you feel like you're getting to the next place where you can run through the whole presentation, then you do what's called an open rehearsal, where you invite people in your target market in to watch, and you'd run through the whole thing, and then you get feedback from them. And you'll start to feel what worked and what didn't work. For example, when I was working on the Think Big Revolution keynote, and you can see a 16-minute excerpt of that on michaelport.com, it's a very different keynote. It's more of a one-man show than what you'd see as a typical keynote. When I was working on that, I had to, the first time I was going to give it was for 3,500 people in Australia at a massive event. And I was the opening keynote. It was a pretty big, deal. It was the most they'd ever paid for a keynote. And they made sure that I knew that so that the pressure was on. They often do this. When they put you as the opening keynote, they say, listen, I'm counting on you.
Because
if this doesn't work, the whole conference is going to be, you're like, oh, yeah. But that's your job. That is your job.
You've
got to be able to handle that pressure. So, but I was not going to go. And so I was creating this presentation. This Think Big Revolution was new. And I wasn't going to do it for the first time for them. So I put on an open rehearsal for 175 people that I invited to come in New York to watch me do the whole thing. Because then you really know what works and what doesn't. But even before I did that, I did an invited rehearsal where I brought in seven people. And
now, who are these seven people? Is this your partner? Is this your business colleagues? Is it friends? Is it part of the target market? I'm just curious. That first sit down small group.
That first group doesn't have to be the target market,
okay.
I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, it's nice if they're there, but it's really important that they're people who are supportive, who don't have their own agenda. They don't feel, you know, they're not the kind of people who are like, oh, I want you to tell the story this way, or you should really talk about this. You know, they don't have that. They're good observers and they're good at reflecting back to you what they saw.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So that's that first group. But the thing that you'll find is that even more important than the feedback you get from them sometimes is you'll feel what's working and what's not. And you get better at that as you get more experience. But in that invited rehearsal, I felt that about 80% of what I had been working on for months was not working.
Ouch.
And I had 2 weeks before the open rehearsal for 175 people. Now, in that particular case, I made that open rehearsal paying. People paid $175 to come to that. And because I have a really good tribe built around me, I was able to do that. And that's what you teach people. So they can see the value in that in this particular situation.
Sure.
So the stakes are raised even higher because it's not, hey, this is like a free open rehearsal thing. This is, you're paying. You want to see something great. I've got to deliver, even though this is an open rehearsal.
Right.
But I knew I had to make changes before that, not only in 2 weeks. I rewrote 80% of the entire speech in a week, memorized and rehearsed that new speech in a week, and performed it for that open rehearsal for 175 people. Then 2 weeks later, I did it in Australia. And so you're constantly working, you're constantly changing, you're constantly getting feedback, both by doing it for others and feeling whether it's working or not. You know, if the joke doesn't land, it's not working. You got to fix the joke. And then by doing it for an open, a larger audience, and you keep going from there.
Sure.
And that's the rehearsal process. Table reads, content mapping, blocking, improvisation and rewriting, invited rehearsals, open rehearsals, and dress and tech rehearsals. So after six, which is the open rehearsal, dress and tech is just continuing to work on the technical elements of your presentation to make sure that you don't have to think about when you press a button if you're going to use any kind of visuals. Mm-hmm. It's not a question. You never have to look at them. They're almost like they come out of your mouth.
Right.
They're just such a part of the presentation that it's seamless. But dress is something that I think you should incorporate earlier on when you're rehearsing, wear what you would wear when you're performing.
I love this.
Because especially if you're a woman, because sometimes women get dressed up even more and they're rehearsing in their flip-flops, but then they come and they wear a pair of 5-inch heels when they give the speech and they look like they're uncomfortable. Mm. So really watch your shoes. Men, you know, if you've got shoes that are slippery, you're going to have trouble moving really well on the stage because a lot of times stages are slippery. Even hotel ballrooms where there's no stage, the carpet is sometimes slippery if you have, you know, wooden soles that are not scuffed up. And then women, if they're wearing a shirt that's tight, a skirt that's tight rather, they may not move as well. Or if they're wearing a skirt that's really, really long, it may look like they're going to trip and the audience is uncomfortable. Even if they know they won't trip, the audience feels they may trip and they're worried and then they can't focus on what the person is actually saying and doing. They're worried about the dress. There's so much. I have lists and lists and lists in the book of to-dos and not to-dos. One of the things that people have said they found valuable, the advanced readers, is all of these do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts, do's and don'ts.
Nice.
And then all of the lists of tips, 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 so that you have a lot of reading that is thoughtful, philosophical, very interesting and compelling emotionally. And then there's lots and lots of how to, what not to do, what not to do, what not to do, what to do, what to do, what to do, tip, 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 tip.
Wow. I mean, okay. Man, you're blowing my mind here with some of this stuff. Okay, now, I mean, I'm not the greatest speaker on the planet, but I get paid to speak. I get paid very well to speak. I speak regularly throughout the course of the year around the world. Keynotes, I think the largest audience so far is probably around 900 people, and I was absolutely fine, and I crushed it according to feedback, but I'm still getting ton of great ideas just from listening to this so far. I feel like I could go for like at least another hour.
We could go for days. I mean, I think I'm gonna let me just go talk to my assistant. She'll clear the next 8 days.
There we go. That'll do.
We just keep going. Set some kind of Guinness Book of World Record.
Yes.
World
record. And speaking of going for days, I got to add in real quick here, and I'm going to put you on the spot. And you don't have to say yes or no, okay? You don't have to say yes or no. I'd probably prefer it if you didn't, if it's negative in front of my audience here. But you do mastermind retreats on your boat. John Jantz was there. I love John. Matthew was there. I love Matthew. You were there. I love you. I better get an invite to that boat. I'm putting it out there, man. I gotta, because I've heard about these masterminds, and I mean, I'm a massive mastermind guy, and I love them. And you know, anyway, I'm putting it out there. I'm putting
you
it
put
out.
Put it out there. I'm saying you get an invite first at the next one.
Boom. Boom.
Boom.
There we
Boom.
Go. Boom. Are you now? Listen. This thing gets downloaded like 300,000 times a month. You realize that, right? So
that's fantastic. Okay. No, I got 300,000 people every month. So 3 times 12 is 36. That's oh my God. That's a huge number of people.
Yeah.
There's so many accountability partners. I will be dead if I don't invite you to.
They're
gonna
hunt you down. It's gonna be like a zombie apocalypse or something.
Well, that's actually a beautiful thing to close on. This idea of making commitments and fulfilling them publicly. Mm. Because if you want to work on speeches, presentations, anything that you know is going to get out into the world in a bigger way, if you just decide to do it yourself and work on it yourself, it's less likely to get done.
Right.
But if you go out and make promises, make commitments, invite people to an open rehearsal, say, I'm going to do an open rehearsal 2 months from now on this date, I'd like your commitment to come, et cetera. Well, then you've got to be ready for that. And the length of time it takes to do something is often the length of time, you have to do something is often the length of time it takes to do it. So you got 2 months, you put it together in 2 months. You have 2 weeks, you put it together in 2 weeks.
Just like I realized,
you got to do what you got to do. I had to write 80% over again, write it, memorize it. You got to do what you got to do. And I was nervous on that one.
Right.
That one I was actually a little bit anxious about because I was like, I don't know if I can do this.
Right.
I said, maybe I'll make an excuse and I'll say, you know what, guys, I'm going to do a working rehearsal where I'll stop and start. And then I was like, you know what? That's just a cop out. Yes. I got to go all the
way. Yes. And you know what? I know many speakers that even with that gut feeling, even with knowing deep down inside their belly that 80% of that speech wasn't working, with only a couple of weeks to go before that big keynote, I know a lot of speakers that, as we say in London, would have just given that complete bollocks, ignored it, and gone ahead and just done the speech anyway. And that's a crying shame as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe I'm different, but I just have so much reverence for the stage. And
agreed.
when you're asking people to sit in that room for that long period of time, you know, that's a big ask. I mean, look, if someone didn't like our interview, they can just turn it off after 5 minutes.
Right.
But when you've paid to be in the room, or you know, you're stuck in a middle seat and you can't leave.
Right.
And you
right.
want to, it's not good. So you got to do everything in your power to love that audience, no matter what they're doing. They could be thumbing their nose at you. You work as hard as you possibly can to be in service of them, because that's your job. And have so much reverence for the stage and reverence for audience members and reverence for people that really, really care about being in service of that audience.
Okay. I got one last final question for you.
Yeah. What's that?
And I don't know whether it's going to be an easy one for you to answer, because I know after saying all those things you've just said, it might be a tough one. I'm going to throw it at you anyway. What is more important for a keynote speaker? Is it a strong opening or a strong finish?
Finish.
I like
that. Now, the opening is, of course, important, but you can move very smoothly and gracefully into the opening without a big splash. The opening doesn't have to, you know, be fireworks.
Sure.
Because sometimes they're just getting used to you, and sometimes a really smooth, easy opening is actually better because they're just getting used to the way you speak
right.
and the way that you move and your energy. And sometimes they need that time before you can start, you know, bringing out some more of the theatrics. But the close is so critical because it's the last thing they remember.
Mm-hmm.
So there are three different things that people in audiences remember most. Number one, something crazy that happens. Like, for example, I fell off the stage giving a speech once right into the orchestra pit.
Nice.
Yes. And I was right on the edge. I was just teetering over. I was really moving forward and I had this overly excited, and I slipped and you heard a big crash. And I did what the little kids do. I went, I'm okay. And the audience erupted with laughter.
Right.
It was great.
Right.
It was great. And then I ran back up on stage. Now, if something like that doesn't happen, then you're cool. They're not going to remember anything crazy, but they'll remember the most emotional moment, you know, when something really touched them. Or if it's a curriculum-based speech and there aren't as many emotionally driven experiences for them, they'll remember something that touched them intellectually. And lastly, they'll remember the end. So the end, the closing at the end is very important. So we don't want to just say, I guess my time's up. Thanks. Or we don't want to do this. We don't want to do the, if you remember just one thing.
Right.
Because then that suggests that you really only needed about 3 minutes for your whole speech.
Right, right, right.
That's the only thing they should remember. The rest was a waste of time.
Somebody else pointed that out to me. Very, very good speaker. You probably know of her, Patricia Fripp.
I've met her once. I don't know her well, but I have met her once.
Very good speaker. Fellow Brit, NSA Speaker of the Year several times in the U.S., and she actually saw me on stage. She's actually seen me speak several times in different shows around the U.S. And I think it was probably the first. She's great because she always gives me feedback. The first time she ever saw me was probably 4 years ago, and I was still really just starting to kind of find my feet as a speaker. And she came up to me, she said, "Darling, you are fantastic. You're a successful businessman and you look like it. You love the stage and it loves you. But if you say the word stuff one more time, I swear," and she noted it down like as a tally. I said it like 12 times in 45 minutes or something. So now it's I never say the word stuff. Yeah. It's a weak word. She said, "Get more specific. Get more specific." So, and then the other time was she commented on something else. And then I said, "Well, okay, I take it all into consideration. Can I buy you breakfast so you can tell me more about how bad I really am?" And so we had breakfast the next morning and she carried on coaching me and she's amazing. So yes, I'll let you continue.
Sure. And, you know, there are some people who offer really good feedback because they have expertise. And then there are other people who they know what they like, but they don't really have much to say in the way of what would help. So, you know, it's we all know if we liked a movie or not, but we have no idea how to make a movie.
Right.
So it's very easy to point out what we like or don't like about somebody else who's a performer. But, you know, so we can decide, I think, who we take our advice from. I think that's important. I don't think we have to take it from just anybody around.
Agreed, absolutely.
Because some of your work will resonate more with some people and less with others.
Yeah.
So we want to be discerning with respect to who we take our advice from.
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah. And lastly, we don't want to end a speech by saying, "Oh, I wish I had more time to cover everything, but I guess, you know, we have to stop now." That also really puts a real downer on the end. And I also suggest staying away from Q&A at the end of a speech.
Me too. I don't like it. I used to do it when I first started speaking just because I saw other people doing it. But now if I'm given a 45-minute slot, I'm going to speak for 45 minutes, not for 35, and then do Q&A. I'm so glad that I've got that one right because I hear it from you now, and that's good.
Well, there are Q&A. Audiences love Q&A, so there are ways to do it that really work well. So what I often recommend the organizer does is I say, "Well, you know, give me the spot to speak and – we can even make that 45 minutes instead of an hour." Then give them a short break and have them come back in and we'll do Q&A as if it's a panel. So we'll just put two chairs on the stage.
Yeah.
And you'll have the event organizer sitting there feeding me the questions that the audience asks. And then it feels very different. And if you do Q&A right at the end of a speech, they take over the energy in the room for the speech itself.
Yeah, I love that.
And so breaking those up can work well. If they force you to, like they say, you have to have Q&A in your speech. We really want you to do Q&A. Find a place to put the Q&A towards the third quarter so that you leave yourself about 10 minutes to wrap it up yourself so you can take the room back and make sure you're controlling the energy of the room, the pacing, the timing, et cetera. And then, you know, you end on the note that you want to end on.
I love it. Well, this is a great note to end on. What an amazing interview. If there's anybody tuning in right now that wants to, you know, take their public speaking up to the next level, steal the show, michaelport.com, stealtheshow.com.
Yeah, steal the show. You're a wonderful author and a successful author. So, you know, when we release books, we have to give away a million bonuses and lots of incentives for people to buy books because, you know, asking someone to buy a book is a big commitment.
Tough game.
It's not a financial commitment. It's very inexpensive. It's the time commitment. Do I want to invest my time in reading the book?
Right.
And so we offer lots of incentives to help. So stealtheshow.com, stealtheshow.com is a place where you can find those. And I make a promise to everybody. Anybody that buys one of my books, and I get, you know, what, $1.50, $2 a book at most because I publish with big trade publishers. So I'm not taking that money. But if anybody reads a book of mine that they don't like, just let me know and I'll buy them any other book of their choice by another author. Not a $150 table book of photography, but, you know, something within reason that will help them, you know, in the area that I was trying to help them in that they didn't get any help.
See, that right there shows massive amounts of boldness and confidence in yourself and what you're all about. And that, you know, that's impressive, particularly at your level, because there's a lot of really good people out there that know what they're talking about when it comes to this subject. So, I mean, I love the fact that you're offering that kind of bold guarantee. That's good.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. I just think you're fantastic. You know, I'm going to make it out to your think tank one of these days.
Man.
I'm not the best traveler in the world.
Right.
So it's a little far for me personally, but if I was cooler and a little hipper, you know, like not such a big dork.
Cooler and a little hipper. Dude, you were on Sex in the City.
Yeah, but I had hair then. It's totally different.
Yeah.
Then I'd make it out there in a heartbeat. But
right.
I'm thinking 2017. That's what I'm looking
at. Okay, that's good. Well, you know, without a doubt, we'll roll out the red carpet to you. We'll make you very welcome. We'll have a great time with it. And let me tell you something. I cannot wait until we have not, for you guys listening, we've never met Michael and I. So I cannot wait to be able to hang out with you and get to know you a little bit better and, you know, clink a cocktail or two and have a good time as well as do all this great talking as well.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right.
You're
so,
a good man.
Guys, the book, one more time, Steal the Show, from speeches to job interviews to deal closing pitches, how to guarantee a standing ovation for all the performances in your life. It is out now. It's just been published. It's hit Amazon a few days ago. You want to go out there and grab a hold of it. Lots of bonuses over at stealtheshow.com. More info on Michael, obviously, on his website, michaelport.com. Show notes to that, this, and all the others at chrisducker.com/episode126. You've been a beautiful audience, and we have enjoyed performing for you. So until next week, take good care, be kind to each other, and I'll be back at you soon. Bye for now.
If the idea of an entrepreneurial community where you get to learn from the best in the business, as well as rub shoulders, gain support, have access to immediate feedback, as well as nonstop accountability from your peers, is something that excites you, then visit youpreneur.com for more information and to get started on building a business you can truly be proud of today. That's youpreneur.com. We'll see you on the inside.